As a child, the Unitarian suffragist Elizabeth Cady Stanton was terrified of God's anger. She was born in 1815 during the Protestant religious revival known as the Second Great Awakening. This mass movement of circuit-riding, emotional preachers created an outpouring of religious fervor by encouraging ordinary people to make a personal connection with God immediately or risk the worst, eternal punishment. Tortured by nightmares of a furious God sending her to burn in hellfire forever, Stanton would wake up in the middle of the night and jump out of bed. She would pray on her knees for hours that she might be spared from divine wrath. She credits her brother-in-law, Edward Bayard, who helped to bring her up, with her eventual spiritual recovery. As a religious liberal, he did not experience God as furious or punitive. In his view, there was no point in cowering in fear, because a loving God had filled a beautiful world with opportunities to learn and grow. Bayard believed in education for girls and encouraged her to live an engaged and thoughtful life, free from any fear of God's wrath. Stanton later wrote about that period in her life. "My religious superstitions gave place to rational ideas based on scientific facts, and in proportion, as I looked at everything from a new standpoint, I grew more and more happy day by day." She had been rescued from the abuse of anger. Fast forward, 1933. The first Humanist Manifesto, of which many Unitarians were signatories, laid out the principles of religious humanism. A key idea was that religion must no longer be considered the domain of the supernatural. The early humanists said that religion is about actions, purposes, and experiences that are humanly significant. So any emotion we might assign to God or spirit or to the universe at large is in fact merely our projection. It's based not on some essential quality of God, but on our human context and capacity. Humanists sided with Stanton's brother-in-law and against the Second Great Awakening's angry God. A contemporary example of this concept, that how we experience God is primarily about the people projecting their emotions onto a metaphor they created in the first place, is this poem by Cynthia Ryland. God got arrested, but they didn't know it was him because he had on his disguise. It was his guy disguise. He was actually pretty proud of it. It had a tattoo around the belly button, which hurt. Anyway, he got arrested because he got into a fight in a bar when somebody said something about Jesus Christ. Except not in a good way at all. Might as well have insulted God's mother. Now that's a whole other story. Because God, who was only there because he liked the jukebox, lost it. And his anger erupted like the wrath of, oh, right, never mind. Just be careful dropping names in Kenny's Tavern. It might be next to a relative. So Stanton feared God's angry judgment, but Ryland's poetry gives us the opportunity to reflect on a very human emotion. In this iteration, the poem infuses anger into the metaphor of God, but not in the form of a cruel deity. Merely a tattooed dude, now in handcuffs at the police station. What's more human than that? The reality is that anger is a human reality. It can range from the incredibly toxic and abusive, or it can just be a healthy expression of existence, no more or less worthy than any other emotion, and certainly not dangerous or shameful at its essence. All cultures, whether US subculture or cultures across the globe, experience anger, but they don't all express it the same way. And this even applies to how we language it. Germans have a word that I won't attempt to pronounce, but it roughly means a face in need of a slap. I'm not condoning violence, and I would only approve of striking someone in self-defense. But I do find myself appreciating a word that captures those times when someone seems like they must be trying to try me. And did you know that the ancient Greeks differentiated between a short-term anger that doesn't stick around and will just evaporate on its own, and a longer-lasting anger that's permanent? Mandarin Chinese has a specific word for anger directed toward yourself, which the linguist Yao Yao describes as a combination of regret and hate. Apparently, India is a treasure trove of angers. Let me tell you about three really fabulous examples. One, there's a form of anger that translates to when eggplant hits the hot oil. I know I've had those moments. Two, Indians also have words that differentiate between political anger, which you have for the ruling class or maybe your boss, if they're unfair, and personal angers, which you have for a friend or neighbor. Lastly, there is loving anger. You might express this emotion toward your spouse when they have angered you, and you can't help them, and you can't fix it. You can only offer your love. Abhijit Paul, who teaches South Asian literature in the U.S., calls this a mixed bag of love, grief, sorrow, and anger. This image is from the US cultural context. It's from 2018. And it reminds us that silence can also be a way to communicate about anger. Kimberly Seals Allers, an advocate for maternal and infant health, who writes about Black female rage, says that we cannot talk about anger without deliberately acknowledging the ways it's used to control and suppress Black women in particular. She calls this the privilege of rage, because it is not given to all of us equally. This photograph was taken at a protest outside Brett Kavanaugh's hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. In this situation, the righteous anger of these Black women took the form of silence. I think I find it so evocative because I also was and am angry about Kavanaugh. And even though this photograph projects stillness and quiet, I can feel the fury too. I can absolutely tell that this person is mad, even though a piece of tape slash rape culture prevents her from speaking. Yet it's a loud image. And it raises questions. What are the racial implications here? And what does it tell us about gender? How is anger itself racialized and gendered? The psychologist Lisa Feldman Barrett works on the complex nature of anger. She says it's far more nuanced and diverse than any single stereotype could ever encompass. Often anger is seen as one note, just bad, and that's it. But after 30 plus years of studying it, Feldman Barrett now views anger as a whole extended family of emotions. She says that it can serve us well to pay close attention to this family tree. She teaches that learning to identify different members of an emotion family is called emotional granularity, and that it can be a powerful tool for understanding and working with your anger instead of suppressing it. One of Feldman Barrett's students is Michaeline Duclef, who recalls being raised with anger as her emotional currency. Growing up, basic communication included door slamming and phone throwing. When she brought these skills, as she calls them ironically, to her marriage, her husband would ask, "Why are you yelling?" Before she would even realize that she was, in fact, yelling. She learned how to manage her anger in therapy. And she started to practice deep breathing, counting to 10, and just leaving the room. But those strategies didn't release or decrease her anger. They didn't help her get anything valuable from being mad. She was just white-knuckling it through life. Then she learned about Feldman Barrett's concept of emotional granularity. Psychology speak for the ability to understand the specificity of emotion. Here is where the Unitarian Universalist principle of a free and responsible search for truth and meaning pops up and beckons us closer. Emotional granularity, the act of gazing deeply at something that is not obviously helpful or pleasant, just to try to learn more, is a profound act of religious devotion. It is about believing that good can exist everywhere. And then the practical benefit is that when we practice detecting nuances of anger, then we can better understand it. If you might like to attempt this, you can begin by taking a broad, general statement, like, "I'm mad," and make it more precise, like, "I've been frustrated all week," or, "I am displeased," or, "I feel road rage." Studies show that the more emotional granularity a person has, the less likely they are to shout at or hit someone who has hurt them. And they're also less likely to binge drink when they're stressed. Our Wonderbox story is one way we might launch this lifelong process for children, by giving them ideas about how to express anger, and by setting the tone that everyone can and should be allowed to have feelings and to name them. I'm like Cindy in that it has not always been easy for me to even identify when I am angry, let alone why and how. I want the young people in my life, my own kids, and also our fellowship children in general, to have a big vocabulary when it comes to the kinds of emotions that I learned in my own childhood weren't convenient or acceptable or positive. And that is why we read grump, groan, growl at home. You may have heard my youngest shout, "Hey, that's our book," when it came out of the Wonder Box. Teaching my kids that all feelings are allowed is a surprisingly spiritual task. It didn't exactly come naturally to me, and so I've had to stretch into it, but I try to show them what it looks like to live in mutual relationship with our hard feelings, because the alternative is that you have to carry them through life like shameful secrets. Witnessing how my kids both struggle with and succeed at this has actually been hugely helpful to me in my own learning and growth. In our family, we are discovering that being granular with our anger or any other emotion can be healing. It forces us to pause and communicate with each other. But more importantly, it's a mechanism for checking in with oneself. It's a slowdown strategy and a powerful tool for regulation and eventually transformation. It lets us absorb information about what our anger means, and then we can process how best to handle it. When I was a hospital chaplain, my internship supervisor taught me about a similar process called the action reflection model. Instead of acting as fast as possible and then reacting to your reaction, that's how I usually live, she invited her students to just wait, to breathe, to reflect, and then when you're ready, like when you've learned something about the impact of the action you just took, or you've learned something about your anger, for example, that it's actually fear talking, or that maybe you need a nap, whatever the lesson may be, then you're ready to dive back into your next action. Anger is often about action. And while that can look like spinning off into an abyss out of control, it can be a gift too. Strong emotion can propel us. Fellowship member Bob Williams, who gave me permission to share this, uses the word discomfort to describe his anger at unfairness, large and small. He coined the alliterative phrase, driven by discomfort, to describe how he uses discomfort anger as fuel. It helps him focus his energy into figuring out how to help change what needs to be different. He's found a way to name with specificity the type of anger he experiences. That's called emotional granularity. And then that insight helps him externalize it as a motivating force rather than letting it be an internal corrosive. Otherwise, I could imagine it eating at him from the inside, because anger can do that. Perhaps you are not convinced that anger can be healthy, that expressing it can be anything short of pathological. But here's the thing. The problem with refusing to allow bad emotions is bigger than only that we are forced to suppress them and their potential wisdom. The other part is that it would leave us performing the good emotions all of the time. And who wants that? Danish psychology professor Svend Brinkmann calls this the culture of positivity, and he is against it. Happiness, he points out, is simply not the appropriate response to many situations. Even worse, requiring us to fake it can leave us emotionally stunted or even traumatized. For example, Brinkman likens workplace insistence on employee happiness to thought control. Of course, he is careful to note that there's nothing wrong with having a naturally sunny disposition. There's certainly nothing amiss if you can access deep joy. If it's not coerced, then it's real. And that is wonderful. Just like anger, it too is real. To pretend otherwise, especially in this political climate, is a major delusion. Letting ourselves feel and listen to our anger is not to let it run amok. It doesn't mean that we're giving it the driver's seat. Rather, honoring its presence in our lives can actually help us guard against it going toxic. In this sense, our rage, our discomfort, our anger is in fact a blessing. It's an asset. It's a resource. It exists to be experienced, and it can teach us if we follow its lead. So how might this learning unfold? We have resources as varied as biblical stories, historical figures, contemporary poetry, Disney musicals, children's books, and even our own silence and words to help us describe and explore our anger. These are all tools with which we can freely and responsibly search for truth and meaning. Let us figure out how to use our anger to serve us and not to swallow us, to help us always ask this question: how might anger serve us in love and healing?